The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. And the purpose of this podcast is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not just fixating endlessly on the problems themselves. And our guest this week is Ruth Ben-Gion. She is a professor at NYU, author of a great book called Strong Men, and has the Substack Lucid, which details her insights and tips on how to have an effective resistance. She is a preeminent scholar of pro-democracy movements pushing back on authoritarian regimes, those so-called strong men. And she writes what I also love to call applied history, which is looking for useful insights from history that we can apply to our times. Ruth, it's great to see you.
Really delighted to be here.
So your book, Strong Men, deals with a gamut of strong men, air quotes around that, from history, Hitler and Mussolini to Pinochet, Franco, Berlusconi, on to the present day, and inclusive of other figures at that time. You have been writing usefully about the lessons that successful pushbacks to autocratic power grabs can look like, and have distilled them to a series of maxims. And that's where I want to focus our conversation. But before that, I just want you to lay out the best historical comparisons to what the U.S. is undergoing now.
You know, in some ways, there's not that many comparisons due to the speed at which this Trump 2.0 is unfolding. He came to power via election, not a coup, but the speed of changes, the wrenching changes in foreign policy, domestic policy, the turn to authoritarian practices we're seeing with manhandling and arrests of judges and elected officials, all in the first months, doesn't really have a parallel in other cases where authoritarians came to power via election. So the first months of Putin, of Erdogan, of Orban, who's a model in other ways, he's the muse of the GOP. This is very different. And part of it's because Trump was there before. I wrote Strong Men during his first term. So in that sense, we're in uncharted terrain, and it resembles more what happens after a coup. That said, the progression of things, the targets trying to, you know, delegitimize and go after Democrats, judges, the press, these are the usual suspects who are persecuted by authoritarians. So there's a lot that he's taking from the classic authoritarian playbook.
And I think what one of the things that's different and dispiriting for those of us who give a damn is that we did it to ourselves a second time after he tried to overturn an election on the back of a lie that led to an attack on our Capitol. You know, that ain't Grover Cleveland. Is there any parallel on that front? Because it seems to deepen the difficulty, though not the sense of urgency and purpose.
Yeah, there's a couple of rules here. Is that, you know, if you are out of power and you've got serious legal problems, you're under investigation, you've got charges against you, regular politicians don't want to run for office again because, you know, investigative journalists start looking at you, there's a spotlight on you. But if you're a strong man, you feel compelled to run for office to get back into power to make your legal problems go away. And so Trump is in line with Berlusconi, who came back twice, actually, each time under investigation, just like Trump. And Putin, who ran for office under investigation. Netanyahu is a very good example, needed to come back and to do his judicial reform initially. It was sparking the biggest protest, nonviolent protests in this before October 7th. So when a strongman comes back, and this was true with Orban also, who was a much more moderate figure, they are always far more motivated to act in a repressive manner and act quickly. And so we're seeing that unfold in the United States now.
I should note that the phrase strongman is said with some irony because that's what they try to, the myth they try to create. But the people who know them best historically often have the dimmest view of them. I was struck by one quote from the long-suffering wife of Mussolini after he was toppled murdered by a crowd with his mistress, that she always saw him as a weak man, not a strong one. And that's a characteristic we need to keep in mind. Strong men are always weak inside, and they tend to appeal to people who feel weak. That does need to be said, right?
Yeah, that's very important. I use the category because aside, along with chapters on the usual things people talk about when they study authoritarians, like violence and corruption and propaganda, Strongman's the first book to include a chapter on machismo and talk about virility and manhood. And so I use this term. It is ironic because one of the big themes of the book is what a chaos and how weak and impulsive these people are behind the scenes. And I actually wrote the book to debunk the idea that they are efficient, they're, you know, master strategists, whether it's Trump or Putin or Mobutu. But I wanted to show how this kind of ruler is a subset, and that's the strongmen who use their manhood. They have an image of their masculinity, and they use that to sell themselves to people.
And especially when people's masculinity feels threatened or their self-determination, usually after a period of rapid social changes, you also point out there's a backlash. I want to get to the useful lessons that people can take, because that's one of the things I think there's a deep hunger for right now. What can we do? And what can we do, not in an inchoate way, but informed by the best practices of history? You have a series of maxims, five, I believe, that you've been building out that apply to our time. I want to run through each of them and then unpack them a little bit. Let's start with the first.
So these are about resistance, and we are doing these things. Not only there's been massive legal resistance to stop Trump's abuses of power, Trump and company, but we've been building a protest movement. So the first is that it's very important that protests, mass nonviolent protests, the accent on nonviolence, is one of the most kind of, this is studied a lot by political scientists. It's one of the most effective ways to resist authoritarians. And so that's one. Second, you have to think of this as a long game. And so what dissidents from regimes teach us is that resilience is important, and think of each action as something in a longer process, that we're building something. That's the second. Third is use all the tools and spaces of opposition that you have now, because you don't know if they'll be available in the future. And four is the importance of unity. Present a united front, and we'll come back to that. And then five is really about at a time when, you know, at its root, in its essence, authoritarianism is a nihilistic political system and practice, because it strips everything of value. It's just about lies and force. And so in resisting, however we do it, we model the values that we would like to see in politics and in the world. So those are my five that I'm developing.
Those are so important. Each of them resonates with me in a different way, and have real concrete lessons rooted in history. The nonviolence piece, your first one, which is about the importance of nonviolent mass protest. This seems to be a discipline. The philosophy of nonviolence, first articulated by Mahatma Gandhi, adopted by and evolved by Martin Luther King. We have seen elements of the far left, certainly the far right, embrace more violent forms of protest. That is profoundly counterproductive, it seems to me. There is a deeper discipline in nonviolence that we need to study and apply today. So dig into that, why it's so important.
Yeah, I'll preface it by saying that for authoritarians, whether it's left or right, they really do see force and violence as the way to change history. And that's what Donald Trump was doing when he incited a violent insurrection to try and stop a peaceful transition of power. And he inculcated this in people. In fact, this struck me so much, I'll never forget it. In the summer of 2024, Donald Trump was campaigning at the Iowa State Fair, family-friendly event par excellence. And Matt Gaetz showed up to support him. And he said, "Only through force can we bring change to a corrupt place like Washington, D.C." And I thought, okay, because that's what from my earliest studies of fascism, they believe that force and from intimidation to outright violence is the way that you bring about change. So nonviolence in the face of oppression, if you're trying to bring about change and you're resisting, you're protesting in public, it's very, very important that it be nonviolent because violence divides us. It divides the movement. There are people who don't believe in violence, most of them. The second is that effective protest can be grassroots, is often grassroots. But really effective protests, you need elite partners. You need the people who have a lot of influence and money to come and be your partners. And violence totally alienates them. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult because often there are infiltrators or you have sectors of society. Again, this is how the right operates, but the far left who believe that violence it has to be in the mix. But nonviolent mm-hmm. protest is the most effective protest.
And we should say it's because, and that is true reportedly with this administration as well, there is sometimes a desire for a pretext to ratchet up violence or oppression. The form of the often invoked Insurrection Act, which seems to be a card being held in this administration's back pocket. They want to inflame a sense of disorder to justify larger police actions or militarization of the police and military against U.S. citizens. The second is resilience. Now, I did my thesis on Václav Havel, and so he's one of my heroes.
So and, you're the expert on this. Yes.
Well, no, I deeply admire the resilience, that nature of heroism, the dissidents around the world who I think we should be constantly celebrating. But all of a sudden, their stories having new relevance today. Talk to us about how to cultivate resilience.
Yeah, so I think that self-care is important, actually, not burning out, because the overwhelm that, and it's happened with this blitzkrieg, hitting you on all fronts, flooding the zone, right? All of these techniques are designed to flood your nervous system, make you feel hopeless. So authoritarians want you to feel overwhelmed, helpless, and hopeless so that you don't try and do anything. And so being resilient means also knowing how to dose your media consumption. Each one of us has our own risk tolerance and also our own threshold for overwhelm. So that's important. Also, if you engage in a protest and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere, you don't give up. This is the lesson of dissidents who were in long-term situations of oppression, like Havel, or the people who protested Pinochet, 17 years. Franco, 36 years. These people get in and then they don't leave. You know that Putin has been in power as long as Mussolini, and Orban's been in power as long as Hitler now. So you have to think of
each
resistance action. it's a long game, and you have to be resilient and not give up. You take, as Martin Luther King told his civil rights protesters, you take a moment to regroup, and then you come back to the struggle.
And I would say, from a Havel perspective, the importance of keeping a sense of you got to be a happy warrior. That's not a Havel term, but he would find energy in the absurdity. There was a sense of fun in the Velvet Revolution because the recognition of the absurdity and hanging a lantern on that of authoritarian power grabs is itself sort of galvanizing. There's not an answer. Authoritarians, have bad senses of humor, among other things.
No, they don't want to be poked fun at. And you see, actually, in the No Kings protest, the signs, there was an exuberance, there's a joy to be poking fun, but together, because you're doing it together, and you're coming, there's a synergy and an energy that's generated. There's a great book on protest in Putin's Russia that talks about that, that I use for strongmen. And joy seems to be the last thing that you would think, like one of the ways that Pinochet was defeated. This is a horrible military dictatorship. They had a march for joy. And I'm so struck by this every day. Who would have a march for joy in the middle of a bloody military dictatorship? But they did. And it became the largest movement, and it contributed to the fall of the regime. It was in the late 80s. So resilience and optimism and hope can seem, very naive to some, very idealistic, but they actually work.
I couldn't agree more. Three is the tools and spaces of opposition, using them while you have them. Explain that and root it in a lesson from history.
There are myriad ways to protest and myriad forms of protest. We are seeing them in every sector can protest, of society can protest in their own way, meaning they can take actions rooted in their expertise. So we've seen myriad lawyers organizing and prosecutors and people organizing to reverse the abusive use of the judiciary. So there's been a whole legal resistance, which has been very effective. There's been popular resistance. There have been educators resisting, college presidents like Michael Roth of Wesleyan coming out. So use the spaces and tools is that each one of us has our own way and of resisting in our own sector. Economic boycotts, the Tesla protests were very anti-Tesla protests, very instructive in this regard, because they combined spontaneous kind of grassroots protest with economic boycott. People didn't want to buy Tesla, and also a kind of tarnishing of the brand, that people became embarrassed to be driving these cars that they loved. And this actually was very impactful. So that's an example also of
but
the myriad
but please
ways
don't
protest.
Commit violence or destruction of property.
No,
please.
That's right. So here we go back to the first. The violence just discredits everything that you're trying to do.
And when you're using tools, obviously supporting organizations that are trying to do the right thing with your dollars, with your patronage, examples of when some of these tools and spaces disappear suddenly.
So, for example, if you're a member of Congress, there have been various experiments at trying to, keep it going. You're the opposition party. And gradually Congress and legislatures get purged. And so ideally, as is now the case in Putin's Russia, the legislature, the parliament becomes a rubber stamp. And so there was an experiment in early fascist Italy before the dictatorship was declared, where opposition members who were under terrible physical and other threats from these fascists, they decided to have a principled exit, a moral opposition, and they all of them left parliament and set up an alternative parliament on the Aventine Hill in Rome. It was called the Aventine Succession. So this actually wasn't a good idea, because they were vacating their space And it played into the hands of the fascists who never let them back in. When they tried to get back in, all the black shirts were there, and so that sped the destruction. So that's a reverse example of what you shouldn't do. You don't voluntarily leave the field of battle.
So important. Number four, unity. Now, I take this to mean enough with the narcissism of small differences, the purity tests of politics that can sometimes preoccupy the left in particular. Like, we need to form the broadest possible coalition to defend our democracy and our Constitution.
Yes, that's part of it. And it's very difficult in the United States because we don't have a multi-party system. It's really much more challenging because the Democratic Party isn't necessarily built to be flexible, because in a multi-party system, there's a lot of interchange. You can build coalitions against an authoritarian aggressor. You can experiment with things, and that's been going on, varying degrees of success in Europe and elsewhere. We only have these two parties, and so as you know, those who no longer saw themselves as part of MA, if they didn't want to be part of MAGA, they didn't feel they had anywhere to go. But unity also means visions of solidarity. And I truly believe that one of the reasons for the wildly disproportionate, militarized crackdown response of the Trump government to the anti-ICE protests is that all over America, there was this scenes being generated of regular people coming out spontaneously at risk to themselves to help the vulnerable, to try and stop these thuggish ICE deportations and roundups. And those images of ordinary people showing solidarity and unity with the vulnerable, with the targeted, are anathema to authoritarians, and they have to shut them down.
And this is also not only being the change you want to see, embodying those deeper values, but also, embodying something in Judeo-Christian ethics, right? Which is standing with the most vulnerable at a time of crisis. Five, keep hope alive is what. So tell us about five.
It's very easy to get discouraged and to give up. But hope and optimism have been for some of the most successful protests and changes that have come. The protest is most effective when it's linked to electoral strategies. And so, for example, in Turkey in 2019, Ekrem İmamoğlu was running for mayor of Istanbul. And he consciously embraced this, what he called radical love, and it included hope and optimism. And so he went around, instead of having these authoritarian rallies, he went around walking the streets of Istanbul, and he hugged Erdogan supporters, and his targets were Erdogan supporters. And he created a sense that there was a different destiny that you could have in authoritarian Turkey. And he won. And he's now arrested because he, with this model of hope and loving others and solidarity, he became such a threat to Erdogan because he's the natural person to run for president against Erdogan and win. He would win. And so Erdogan has had him arrested. This is a fast forward from 2019. The same in Poland. In 2023, they had a six-party coalition against the far-right party that had been there for years. And the slogan was the March of a Million Hearts. And Donald Tusk kept using the rhetoric of hope and destiny, that we're here together and there's an energy that we have generated that we can't be stopped. We can do this. And so that's where the kind of optimism comes in, because it's so easy to feel powerless at the apparatus of the state. And so they had the largest turnout in Warsaw since the fall of communism, which translated into the largest voter turnout, and they got rid of their far-right government. So these are examples that have concrete...
What is the one story that you keep coming back to in your mind when you're feeling depleted, when you're feeling a degree of despair about this hole we've dug ourselves into in America right now? What's that renewable resource you story that you hold on to?
Well, I think a lot about the civil rights movement and how we have this huge repository of wisdom and practice that I think we're not drawing on adequately, because that could have seemed, it's an entrenched situation. It was an entrenched situation. It could have seemed intractable. So I think about that. But from my studies, because my book was global, it's really Chile under Pinochet, which suffered terrible, torture and trauma. And then in the 1980s, came together to build a pro-democracy movement of labor and education and all the opposition parties. And they had to march under the guns of the soldiers. And after the first big Democracy Day in 1983, the leader of the major union said, "The main thing we accomplished is that we lost our fear." And from that flowed a trajectory which led to the March for Joy and weakened Pinochet. It also helped that the Americans who put Pinochet in power had soured on him and started helping to, they funded efforts to register people to vote because they'd thrown away the voter. It's a dictatorship. Nobody's voting. So they came back in this extraordinary way in conditions that are certainly far direr than ours today. And everyone knew someone who'd been imprisoned or tortured, and yet they still found it within themselves to come out in million or support the opposition in different ways. And in the end, they prevailed.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, thank you for the words of wisdom, this applied history. We appreciate your work, your insights, and the courage and comfort that your lessons from history give us. Be well.
Thank you.